Hey, Fantastic fans, listen up. I was searching online and I typed in Fantastic Tennis Gifts, as one does, and the Google gods shined brightly down on my search as I discovered an online store full of fun, inexpensive gifts that you must go check out right now. www.racketinc.com. That's www.racquetinc.com. They have everything you need for your tennis playing husband, sister, doubles partner, USTA teammate, doorman, you name it. I ended up buying a bunch of the coolest antique racket wine bottle openers. Never seen anything like it. I even picked up a pickleball court mouse pad for my boss because he's convinced he's a pickleball world champion after playing four times, so he'll love it. You won't be sorry. Check out racketinc.com and their Instagram page, Racket Inc., today for the most unique tennis gifts right now.
Please take your seats quickly, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you.
I mean, they always have a big mouth, they always talk a lot, so it happened before, it's gonna happen again.
Welcome back, you fantastic tennis lovers. I'm your host, John Garica. We are officially closing the book on the first month of the tennis season, and we swiftly move into February, which makes the walking tennis zombie that I become every January so much happier. It was absolutely brutal. It really was. I really slept less than it took for the entire cast of Breakpoint to be bounced from the draws in Melbourne, which was such bad luck, right? Ugh. Anyway, I'm feeling much better now, and I'm excited to recap 1 month of tennis, which I thought was a really great start to the tennis season. And yes, Caroline Wozniacki, you were right. We love our tennis, even on just 4 hours of sleep. Joining me today is the person that could karaoke the hell out of that legendary song. She also happens to be the co-founder of the most important publication in our sport, Racket Magazine. As an accomplished college tennis player herself, a tennis Twitter laureate, an award-winning producer, and our favorite co-host on the Renee Stubbs Tennis Podcast, she's here today to help me break down Breakpoint. And of course, the last month of Aussie Madness, it's the legend, Caitlin Thompson. Caitlin, so great to see you.
Oh my God, that's the best introduction I've ever gotten. Can you please be on my hype team whenever I need to appear anywhere and just introduce me in such a manner? Oh my God, I'm beside myself.
Literally from the day I met you, have I been your hype squad. I've missed you, my friend. Thank you for joining today. I'm going to stay away from your hot buttons. I know, you know, I follow you on Twitter, so I know there'll be no mention of pickleball today. I'm not even going to talk about the Andre Agassi and Andy Roddick $1 million exhibition. I won't even bring it up.
Thank you. You just did, but I'm going to keep it moving and not address that.
Ignore me.
I'm not addressing it, just ignoring it.
Joining us today to round out this truly A-plus tennis team is someone I always love seeing on my TV screen. As a writer, reporter, commentator, and host for all of our very favorite tennis events around the globe, he's covered everything from the Olympics to the Australian Open, and he's just back from Melbourne, where among the many hats he wore, he served as the host for the premiere of the Netflix docuseries Breakpoint. And more importantly, he's the only one of us today that can confirm if that Nike kit can truly hypnotize you when you stare at it up close. It's the fantastic Nick McCarvel.
I mean, can we be honest and say that Francis Tiafoe was really the only one that fully, I mean, he went fully in and he was the only one that fully pulled off said kit.
Listen, I want to know all about it. I can't wait to hear your fashion takes in a minute. I wondered if it's creeped into your suitcase for sure. It's so good to see both of you, Caitlin and Nick.
Thanks, John.
Welcome to our January roundup. Thank you so much. I'm such a fan of both of your work. Truly, I can't wait to jump into the show today and hear all of your takes. I could probably do this with you guys for hours at least, right? And then you add on the Zverev news today and we could just, you know, keep going. You know, 15-month investigation, we get a ho-hum statement from the ATP tour and, you know, I'm not going to be cranky, ATP. I'm not going to do it. I'm having fun with my friends today. So let's jump into today's show. It started out with some exciting news this January, and it was that Netflix would debut Breakpoint to coincide with the Australian Open. Nick, you just came back from Australia. It looked like an amazing trip, by the way. Super fun. How long were you there in total?
I was there for 25 days, and they were glorious, each of them.
I hope you got to explore a little bit. I hope you got to do something.
Not really, John. No, I mean, it's always trading as three New Yorkers here. I think trading New York January for Australia January is always that's the good trade. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I haven't been. It's the only Grand Slam I haven't been to.
2024, baby.
Caitlin, have you been?
No, I have not.
What?
You guys.
I know. I went to Sydney once in the wintertime and I was like, no thanks, hard pass. But I have not been to Melbourne and I have not been during their summer. So I was told I did it wrong, which I'm open to hearing.
You did.
I flew a long way for another winter.
Yeah.
As opposed to a January summer, which feels much smarter.
I will say also, we got true Melbourne, and also you dropped the OU and the R, and pretty much the E as well. It's just Melbourne. The locals, it's literally just the B and the N at the end.
I'm not saying that.
I'm not saying that either.
I know. I know. And I actually got in a disagreement with one of our directors on the world feed. He's like, you're saying it wrong. And I'm like, well, I'm an American. So, but I was converted, Caitlin.
Listen,
I was Melbourne.
This is why you get the microphone and put on camera. And I have a cranky podcast and I'm a Twitter laureate. So I feel like there can be lots of daylight between us on this. I think you should definitely embrace the pronunciation that you feel best reflects you, but I'm not doing it.
Fair.
Besides embracing the dialect, I think one of the highlights for you had to have been hosting the Breakpoint premiere. I loved seeing that you were just front and center there. It looked like a very cool vibe. Can I ask what the buzz was like that night?
Yeah, the buzz was cool. I mean, it was buzzy. I got a phone call the morning of, John. What are you doing tonight? I'm going to the Netflix premiere. Would you like to host it? Sure.
Wow.
So, you know, that's a good phone call to get. No, I have to say, like, TA does these sort of things really well. So we were on site. They were in the theater at where they do all the main press conferences with the players, and good vibes in the room. They did the first episode. They ran the like series teaser. And then we did like a Q&A with a few of the players in this rotunda inside Rod Laver Arena. There was a red carpet. Yeah, it was premiere-y vibes. There was a step and repeat. There was a photo booth. Again, TA does this well where they get the sports people, they get the culture people, they get the tennis people. They all come together. It was the perfect place to do an event like that for Breakpoint.
I love it. I'm guessing the players got a big kick out of watching themselves, at least, right? I mean, it's totally different.
I don't think any of the Breakpointers were actually at the screening. I will say they all came to the party, which, you know, well planned.
Okay.
And then that was really the eve of the Breakpoint curse, because Ila Tomjanovic pulled out of the tournament the next morning.
Exactly.
And Nick pulled out, you know, 2 days later.
I love it. Caitlin, I want to talk Breakpoint with you. As someone I respect immensely in the tennis world, I really wonder what your thoughts were watching this series.
I mean, I have like normal brain, meta brain, galaxy brain takes all day long. But the truth of it is, I have been, and I know I'm talking to two other people who have been waiting for tennis and trying to do everything that we can in our large and big and in between ways to make sure that tennis gets sort of to be in the conversation with culture and a larger, I think, footprint, a larger audience and a more mainstream dialogue. So I kind of knew no matter what this show was going to be like, the very least accomplish that, giving it visibility, giving it sort of stature. So I have like so many different things and micro critiques and micro celebrations, but the truth of it is, I was hoping it would be net positive, and I think very much it is. And so it doesn't really so much matter to me about like, what was the framing? How did we pick our subjects? Did they do a good enough job with X, Y, and Z storylines? Like, sure, and we could do that all day, and there's lots of different ways to be right about that stuff. But I think for me, I'm just so thrilled that tennis has been given a really beautiful camera treatment. It's been given a narrative treatment. It's been given a platform treatment. It's been given an introduction to characters that go beyond, you know, the bounds of a tennis court, and whose narratives are not concerned with how many Grand Slam trophies they have, which in the best of circumstances is incredibly dull and boring to me. So for me, the fact that none of that persisted and it was something new and something fresh feels like value add. My main feedback is, I hope, and from what I've been able to hear in terms of some of the projects we've been working on and now the reception to them after years of having to get like past gatekeepers and try to, you know, get meetings and figure out how to get access to some of the sort of decision makers that would mean that we could do more documentary films or projects or bigger events or whatever it is, it's already helping. And so my overwhelming response is positive. And I think my hope is that this just shows how ripe for storytelling tennis is, and how much people like all of us have been doing our best to try to make that happen. And now we need to kick the door down even more, leave it open for the people who come behind us, and make sure that it stays open, honestly.
Definitely.
Yeah. Yeah, snaps to that. And I will say, John, I watched the premiere and I just haven't had the time to watch anything else. So I haven't seen beyond that. But I will say is all the folks that I've talked to who are not tennis people, count my parents, count the figure skating people I just saw in San Jose, count anyone who's not within, the three of us know this sport so well and in different intimate ways.
Yeah.
The important people are what Caitlin's just talking about is the folks that don't know the sport that well. And so I agree with Caitlin there. And I also will say a couple of years ago, we did this docuseries for the Olympics on ice dancers, and they're really hard to do. They're really, really, really hard to do. So there's a lot of critiquing within the tennis world and why they pick these players and the Netflix curse and all of that kind of stuff. But I agree with Caitlin in the sense of the door's been kicked open in that way. I'd love the announcement, maybe like Indian Wells time, that they're going to do season two. I haven't heard that that's confirmed yet because we need that traction. But I agree, it's a net positive for sure.
Absolutely. Yeah, I completely agree. Plus, I really love the fact that you can get through that tennis ball sound effect and still really find the love in the series, because that was really, I thought that was the fun part. All right. So if we're going to cast season two, we each get somebody. What are we thinking right now, Caitlin? I mean, whose story in life do we want to follow?
I mean, you guys know I'm a giant Benoit Paire fan. I feel like between his journey in the wilderness of whatever existential ennui he's going through,
his
refusal to miss a night at the club, and some incredible on-court brilliance and also like off-court and on-court meltdowns. I mean, he's not the most original answer because we've had him in our pages. We've obviously thought a lot about including his narratives in our world, but like I still think he's somebody who really transcends because he's, you know, cranky and amazing and not for nothing, but like extremely handsome and charismatic, and nobody else has a beard oil sponsorship. So I'm gonna think Benoit, just because I also like, I love that Ons is in it, I love that Arena's in it. Like, they didn't do a bad job picking the players. I love Felix. Like, there's so many good participants that are already, if not necessarily people we've met yet, coming in the second tranche of episodes. Benoit feels like he adds a certain je ne sais quoi. What about you, Nick? I'm very curious what you think.
I'd love to see, like, I think a lot of players were saying this, like, get a couple challenger. I mean, now Benoit is playing some challengers, but get like a Chris Eubanks, who's like right on that line, John, where it's like, show the real toils that these players are going through. I mean, definitely. The glitz and the glam obviously is what Netflix wanted for season one. And also like one of the top doubles players, like Caitlin Christian, or one of these players who are just going week in and week out and just playing everywhere to make a few hundred bucks so that they can float themselves to the next slam. I love to see some of that. And just, you know, I mean, you know, doing your own laundry and booking your own cars and trying to fly in the backseat, you know, not the glamorous life, I think, that season one, I believe, is portraying in that way.
Yeah, definitely. Taylor Townsend. I mean, she even threw her name out in the ring in a press conference too, you know. She said, Netflix, call me, right? That would be great to see a mom, you know, how she handles that. And Azarenka, I would love
Let's go.
Ostapenko is who I would pick, though. That's definitely who I want. I don't care.
Of course you would.
Just like me, maybe just like an MTV docuseries, just me and Ostapenko, just like how she picked, you know, just, I don't know.
She needs her own camera crew, no matter what, for whatever project. I'm 100%. Not sure she plays nicely enough with others to be like incorporated into a Netflix series. Oh, I think she might need her own docuseries.
Exactly.
Centered around Riga Nail. Obviously.
Obviously. Actually, the entire, yeah, that's where it starts. That's right. I'm picturing this now. We're writing this. So it's your producer mind. I love this. I love it. I will say the one thing I really did love about the show was that we got to learn about the players and their teams, like Maria Sakkari, which I thought was really cool to see, which is a great segue into our next topic, because I'd love to talk a little fashion, because Sakkari had my favorite look. I love the gear. I love the kit. Nick, I know it's also fresh in the mind. I know we talked about it for a split second, but the Nike kit up close, are we thumbs up? What are we thinking?
This is coming from a gay man, but I don't really care. Like, I just like,
okay.
As far as kits go, like
oh no, the connection got bad. Oh no. It's just Caitlin and I left on the show. No, I'm just kidding. No.
Oh, I was like, wait, what? No, I will say I love the Francis look. And then what I'll say also is that I love seeing more players wearing differentiated brands. Seeing the Cotton on Thanasi, seeing Lululemon out there, seeing the Penguin brand, seeing Armani, seeing more of these brands. The Nike, to me, the only cringe about Nike is when you've got two Nike players playing against each other in the same damn kit.
Yeah.
The opinion for me, John, is not really there. I'm sure Caitlin has some hot takes, but I it's my biggest pet peeve when we do see two kits facing off against one another. And go back to Ostapenko, more Ostapenko designing her own kit.
More Ostapenko. Actually, Racquet Magazine had a great tweet. It said, once again, pleading with tennis to implement a rule that dictates when players with the same kit face each other, the lower ranked player must wear an alternate away kit. I mean, definitely, right?
Yes. Caitlin, yes. Good job, Racquet. Endorse.
Shout out to Andrew Eccles, who was reading the tweets, who not only managed to get that extremely timely and important message out, which I know Nick and many of us are really thoughtful about bringing up all the time. I also want to credit him for getting us quoted in the New York Times for calling Francis's look the big faux romper, F-A-U-X, which I just feel like is so on point.
Yeah, that really was.
It was great. It was also interesting because, you know, Francis was the only person who wore the look head to toe. And we saw some very poor showings of that kit in various iterations. Like that really wore Shapovalov. He didn't wear it. At one point, Vika was wearing, and I know we love Vika, so I'm not here to slander her on this podcast. But I have to say, her wearing the bicycle shorts on the outside, I'd never seen it before. And I wondered if we should take Nike court to actual court, because I feel like that shouldn't be allowed. So I think for me, tennis being a home for many diverse brands is wonderful.
Yeah.
To Nick's point, seeing Danielle Collins and Ali Risk and Aloe, seeing just lots of different looks that people actually could wear off court.
Yeah.
You know, when Virgil Abloh makes a tutu for Serena that is by many accounts horrifically ugly, but high fashion, but either way is not really accessible for anybody to buy or wear.
Right.
I don't know what that does. Mm-hmm. I guess it's like Nike being like, we have PR moments and we care about hype wear designers more than we care about what people actually wear to play tennis.
Mm.
But for me, like the fact that there's all this preponderance of actually wearable, good looking stuff. Wilson looked really good.
Yeah.
Arta Kostyuk was wearing head to toe
yes.
Wilson.
Yes. Okay.
He looked great, right?
Yeah. And actually I did a few of Kostyuk's matches in Adelaide. And thank you for reminding me that she looked amazing. Yeah, the Wilson stuff was on point.
Very good. Ugo Umbera wears a Wilson as well. So I feel like it's a nice time to sort of remind people what an opportunity it is to dress these players who have some of the best physiques and obviously like most screen time, to the brands that aren't trying hard enough, try harder, and to everybody else who's sort of a newcomer in the space, like what a fun thing it is to see you. So keep it up. That's my take generally on fashion.
We're kind of joking about the away kits, and I love that from Andrew Eccles. But honestly, for a TV product, to have two players wearing the exact same thing it's embarrassing.
It's terrible.
And if you don't have your own kit, maybe you just grab an accessory like Diana Schneider. You know, I loved it. I love stuff like that.
The bandana, it was very Capriati throwback. Yes, I loved that. Yeah.
Bandana, bring it back. I love it. I'm having so much fun today. The 2023 Australian Open was filled with everything tennis fans require: drama, polarizing fashion, some definite upsets, and we had even a surprise baby announcement to kick off the festivities. So since I'm surrounded by tennis media royalty today, I'm eagerly awaiting their thoughts on the first slam of the season. All right, Caitlin and Nick, I asked our listeners via social media what they felt like were the biggest topics from this past month. So I'm going to jump right in and get your takes. We'll start with Naomi Osaka today, and I'll set it up because it's the first official Grand Slam without Roger and Serena. Venus pulls out. We're already missing Barty and Kerber and Svitolina, Halep as well. And then we get the statement from Naomi Osaka that she too is taking some time off the tour. Caitlin, I'm sure you were as surprised as we all were with the Osaka news. Is the tour still in good shape without the two highest grossing female athletes in the world?
Kudos to her agent for signing a whole bunch of deals. Naomi Osaka, at this point, I would pay not to watch her play tennis because it looks like she is having such a bad time. And honestly, I never want to stand between someone deserving and their bag. So like the fact that she can get it and get all those brands to cut her checks, like kudos. But I do think I like watching tennis when it looks like people are pumped to be there. looking no further than Aryna Sabalenka's run
yeah.
makes me realize and remember and be able to show other people who maybe don't know our sport as well. This is fun. This is what tennis should be. It's somebody living large, going for it, and having a roller coaster of emotions, but at the end of the day, wouldn't rather be anywhere else. And I think for me, watching Naomi Osaka in the last couple of years has been a real exercise in like pain management. And look, whatever is going on in her home life, if this next stage for her gives her some other fulfillment, which I absolutely hope it does, and I know that most people in the tennis space kind of feel the same way, then, you know, God bless. But I don't want to see anybody playing tennis on my screen who doesn't look like they are
yeah.
having the worst time of their lives, and it's not for the right reasons. And so for me, I was
yeah.
relieved, honestly, because this kind of keeps her in our world, but not on the hook for another spate of ridiculous and at this point conflicting sponsorships mm. that she's obviously not pumped to be doing. And then the expectations that go with those, which she's not really seemingly
yeah.
excited about, you know, fulfilling or meeting with her tennis. Does that make sense?
Well said.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's an opportunity for us to now talk about newer players. You know, this has been dominated this year yeah. with the Linda Lindas, you know, already to start out the the year. You know, Linda Noskova had another great win this week, beating Muguruza in Lyon.
Oof, Muguruza. Oh my God.
I know.
I'm so sad for her. I really, truly love her.
I'm such a veteran-centric fan. So it's like, it pains me for sure.
What is she going to have to do? What summit
I'm not gonna
of
say
a
it.
Mountain is she going to need to
it.
Get?
I'm not going
to
say
You
it.
Think she needs to fire Conchi?
Did I say that? I didn't say that.
Okay.
I'm going to take a sip of my water just like you did.
While you both sip your water, I think she just needs a couple wins. That's all she needs.
That's it, right?
Yeah.
I feel like she's just had a bit of a bad couple of, I mean, unlucky draws. I know that everybody needs to make their way through the draws, but I just feel like Moogs, all she needs to do is just get a little confidence.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just get it back. Get the mojo back.
I'm excited, though, for the newer players to emerge. You know, I'm learning a lot about them, and that's what I just really love. I love the stories in general, and I love hearing, you know, I thought that's what Netflix really did well, because, you know, you're learning about Sakkaris and the Badosas and Ons Jabeurs of the world.
Mm.
Nick, do you think there is an opportunity to have an Emma Raducanu type player that can get to that popularity kind of phase of their career now? Maybe Netflix helps. I don't know. Do you? I mean, obviously, it'll probably take a grand slam, but is Sabalenka on her way there? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. And I actually think I'll take that question and just turn it a little bit, John, with my answer and say that maybe that's not best for the game, is to have someone who reaches the heights of Raducanu, because look what happened over the next 15 months. And I actually thought she as a 19-year-old handled that so well in so many different ways. And so, you know, we already mentioned Kostyuk. We mentioned the Lindas, Fruvertova and Noskova. Noskova, I did several of her matches in Adelaide. I'm so impressed. She's got everything on and off the court that you would want for a young tennis player. And so let's be patient and let some of these women build up those resumes and build up the wins and have the confidence. And, you know, even someone like Kostyuk, she's been open over the last couple of years about how tough it was in 2018 being 15 and being in the third round of a major. So
yeah
I think we often want sort of, you know, will Sabalenka go to the next stratosphere? No. Frankly, she won't right now. I mean, maybe she'll become more familiar to folks now that she's won a Grand Slam. Will she get several more? She certainly has the game to. But I love to see some resume building, some win building for these women, because I think that the longevity is then what the fans love. We're still talking about Muguruza. People love her because she's had all those comebacks.
I also just want to briefly shout out, Nick, you did such a wonderful job for the World Feed.
Thanks.
I know, obviously, you were on a lot of the main calls at Adelaide and some of the tournaments in the run-up to the Australian Open. For me, especially given the state of commentating on the main channels, like getting to the World Feed, finding the World Feed is a savior. There are so many more sort of qualified voices. It's so much more fun. It's so much more knowledgeable. They do the research. They do their homework. They're a diverse group.
Mm.
Like, I just cannot recommend it enough. And most people I know, especially those who don't listen and watch tennis as much as we all do and know who and how to sort of accommodate existing biases and maybe some frustrating voices who seem to have lifetime job appointments,
yeah.
The World Feed is your best friend. That is such a great resource. And it's so often there are some of the best working commentators in the game. And you were a real true delight.
Thank
I heard you on more matches than I can think about. And it's something I always try to listen to. And then when the feed goes from the World Feed to the main feed, I go to Spanish.
Amazing.
It's true.
Well, no, I mean, I think that, and that's also, it goes back. Thank you, Caitlin. That's nice. That's really sweet of you to say.
And I know
you mean it. But John, I think that's the point is that, you know, we always want the big star, but what about all these incredible stories and how do we tell those stories? And I think that's really, I mean, that's what I take serious when I do the 3 weeks and I don't go explore Australia because I'm there to work and I'm there to help tell the stories as best I can.
This is tennis therapy today. It's like tennis church almost. I love it. I love today.
It's in session.
Amen.
Therapy is in session, John.
It is.
Our mother, Mary Pierce.
We're jumping onto our second topic today. I'm always accused of not covering the men on this show, and it's true. I'm very WTA centric. It's true. But I want to spend at least a solid 45 seconds talking about the men, at least.
Fine.
Let's begin our Melbourne roundup with the gents. Caitlin, thoughts on Sir Andy Murray in general? I mean, especially the Berrettini and Kokkinakis match. I want to highlight his legendary status in stratosphere for sure. What do you think?
Full legendary status. I mean, when you said you wanted to start with me talking about the men, my first response was pass. But it's hard to pass up an opportunity to talk about Andy Murray just because everybody can agree that Andy Murray is such a win for our sport. So thank you for tricking me and getting me to talk about men's tennis.
No, same. It's the only way I'll talk about it too. So there we go.
No, you are. I do think this, and I'm not here to not throw bombs. If men's tennis was just best of three, maybe we would still be watching Andy Murray compete to the end of tournaments. I mean, maybe not. He's had God knows how many surgeries and resurfacing on his hips and all this stuff. It's just, it's such a terrible sort of way to put your thumb on the scale of a certain type of tennis, a certain type of body, a certain type of age. And to me, like, Andy Murray should be in the back half of, and he should have been his whole career, of draws. And I think when you look at a sport that gets people off the court at four, I know we want to give Andy his flowers. Andy has gotten his flowers for those two late night matches, and he will not miss them from me. But I think more importantly for me is to sort of think about what sport regularly asks its tournament staff, its players, its ball kids, its physios to stay on site 4, 5, 6 in the morning if you think about cool down and all the stuff that they need to have available to them. And it's just like, it's wrecking their bodies in a way that is awful and denies us the best tennis, the best storylines. And then you really have only the players left who are marathon runners as opposed to sprinters, as opposed to different styles. And I think it's time to just say like, hey, listen, best of five was a really important format when matches were 20 minutes because they were on grass courts with wooden rackets. I've played on grass courts with wooden rackets. It takes about 20 minutes to play a set. Like, that's a very, very different thing from what we're experiencing now. It's just, it's dated. It's time to move on. And I think we want these players to have a healthy, you know, experience playing our sport. And we can't expect them to go through this kind of like extreme physical torture during slams for our own entertainment, but then really their inability to compete, not only for the rest of the tournament in some cases, but like sometimes for the rest of their year or maybe even careers, you know? And I just think it's like irresponsible and what a miss. He should be an illustration of what you lose when you force a modern game into an antiquated format. And so I would love if he were still around and healthy. Hard to imagine that he does that very often, but when he does, I'm not only cheering, but I'm also like looking at the powers that be and being like, cool, you blew it. Let's fix it, you know?
I'm signing that petition for sure. I mean, 5 hours and 45 minutes on court. I mean, I'm not doing anything for 5 hours and 45 minutes except for sleeping and working, probably. I don't know what else you can possibly do. I guess that's what he was doing, I guess. Nick, what was the buzz in Melbourne about all the American men? I know we'll talk quickly about this, but who impressed you the most there?
I mean, you know, Shelton's got to sort of rise to the top firstly, and the fact that it was his first trip abroad. I think moreover, too, just, you know, taking in all that experience and like Caitlin saying, actually going off of the best of five, is imagine that for Ben Shelton. I think he had played a couple, maybe just the one US Open best of five, and he literally cramped. He physically couldn't get through it.
Yeah.
It was a humid day in New York, but I think the buzz around him, John Cain Arena's, that People's Court, where it's a little bit of a walk from the rest of the grounds, but they've made it into, and Nick Kyrgios has helped them do this, they've made it into the People's Court, and Shelton was just like shining there. He really wanted to be on that court. And you asked the Raducanu question, John. I think that Shelton's a good example of a young player. Obviously, there's a lot of sex appeal there. There's a lot of the backstory there. There's a flashy game. And so he felt the most buzzy out of the Americans. I mean, obviously, I was disappointed for Mackie. I know Mackie really well, to beat Rafa and then to have that injury crop up and not be able to play his full match next up. And Brad Stein was on our World Feed team. He's Tommy Paul's coach. And I will say that, and I won't forget JJ Wolf and the success that he had too, but Tommy Paul's doing the work, guys. I mean, he's...
Don't sleep on Tommy Paul. Listen, do not.
Do not. And even I, even Brad, like halfway through the tournament, I was like, Tommy looks great. And you know, there a couple years ago, I think there was a lot of in talk at the USTA about, is he working hard enough? Can he? Will he? You know, Seinstein is in the best damn shape of his life and is a really sneaky good tennis player. Not sneaky good, but like he just made a slam semi. But there's more skill and nuance to the Tommy Paul game. And I think we finally got to see that.
I heard something amazing about Tommy Paul because I got to host Renee Stubbs' show on Amazon, which was so fun and also terrifying.
Which you're killing, by the way. Absolutely.
Well, listen, no, the first day was a total disaster. I have so much more, even more respect for people who do live TV. Oh my God, everything went so bad for the first like 30 minutes. I literally thought I was going to have to fake my own death and never show my face again. I was like, I don't think I can go back there after that, what just happened. But anyway, one of the things that I was, it was fun, is I got to like basically ask all my friends to come on the show. And I got Kara Connor, who wrote a big fun piece for New York Magazine about don't sleep on Tommy Paul. And so we were like on Tommy Paul watch, and it just so happened to coincide with his run to the semis. So I was like, oh my God, look at me. I'm a prognosticating genius. But also you can't help but really kind of, once you get your eyes on him, like kind of, oh wow. And I heard from our sort of camp friends and like some of our coaches that kind of like circulate around the racket universe that he apparently at like Lake Nona has the most oxygen volume intake in his lungs, has the highest jump off the box, has like the best reach. Like apparently he's like known around that universe of player development as like being the most physical specimen. And like you look at him and you're like, yeah, of course he's like very fit and tall and he, you know, looks great. But just what a sort of like physical freak he is and how he's just now starting to kind of unlock his potential was really interesting to kind of think about, because I'd never thought of him that way. I just thought like, oh, he's kind of like a nice kind of calm, chill, under the radar kind of guy. But then like, oh, wow, interesting. He's got all this physicality that he can bring to it. And maybe there's like more ceiling for him than other players. I don't know if that's something Brad Stein talked about, but now Brad isn't Stein the new Davis Cup coach, Nick? Isn't he?
I don't know. Did they just announce that?
I think he was certainly in the running to be. So I feel like maybe there's like a bit of a sea change in American men's tennis, kind of speaking to your question, John, about who was generating buzz down there, but also like what that might mean for some of the way we, you know, from an American centric point of view, kind of evaluate and think about promoting, developing, and like sort of further supporting these young guys.
And Tommy's kind of, if we're going to still talk about men's tennis, Tommy's kind of floated under the radar of, you had Riley, you had Francis, you had Taylor Fritz. But Tommy's part of that group. And because of multiple factors, he wasn't able to find his best. And now he is. And also the learning, think of all the learnings that he's taken from those guys. I mean, they're all very close. So yeah, watch this space, Tommy Paul. I don't think that semifinal run was a fluke to me. That was a breakout run. And I think he's going to back it up. And he's good on every surface. He can play on clay. He can play on grass. He can play on hard.
There we go. I mean, as someone who doesn't really follow men's tennis that closely, I did love some of the stories. Michael Moe getting to the third round as a lucky loser. I mean, there were some stories that I followed that I found myself just
awesome story.
Kind of being, being really excited about. So yeah, that's really great. But not as excited I was about the women. So let's talk about the ladies in Melbourne. It's on to the ladies. So much to celebrate from court 14 to center court for Rybakina.
Amazing.
She said, don't fuck with me. Vika said, hey, don't forget about me. And then Sam Stosur and Sonia Mirza said, hey, okay, folks, that's enough for me. You know, we had we had a lot of fun stuff to talk about. Caitlin, so many great stories from the ladies' side. What were the most compelling stories for you this past year and especially in Melbourne?
I mean, you hit on a few of them right there. I think Rybakina, kind of to Nick's point about being so excited to see Tommy Paul being poised now to back it up. I remember being really excited about him as he came really close to beating Casper Ruud at the US Open. You know, you really like when a player can like have a breakout, but then also kind of keep building on it. And for me, Rybakina and her performance after a great Wimbledon, do I think Ons kind of threw the match away to her from nerves and like maybe a mismatch of tactics? A little bit, but you know what? She took it and ran with it and she deserved to be there and she got to the finals and she got back to the finals this year. So to me, Rybakina, her like ice cold serving big babe tennis stuff, really, really happy to see her make the final. I thought there were so many amazing sort of like moments. Vika to me was another big one, not only because she made a great run, great to see her back at the late stages of a tournament making the semis here, but also like kind of talking about her new mentality and how basically she was kind of like phoning it in for the last year or two. And anybody who's seen Vika play or practice, like, it's hard to describe what she does as phoning it in. She's so intense and like so full on from point A to point Z. On the other hand, from her own admission, she wasn't necessarily like dreaming big, hoping big, thinking big, because, you know, I guess it's so easy after a long time to just kind of think about it as like going through the motions, and really challenging herself to have a new approach, a new mentality, and watching it pay off is really cool. The best match I saw Vika play, and this is after she survived a really great onslaught from Madison Keys for about a set and a half before Madison does something that she does sometimes, which is like kind of run out of steam. She stayed in there. She weathered it. She waited for her opponent to kind of run out of juice and then was exactly right where she needed to be tactically. She did the exact same thing in the next round where she played Ju Lin, who had beaten Maria Sakkari, and really brought the kitchen sink at Vika, who had to literally, up until match point where she hit that incredible backhand on the run passing shot cross court, bring her absolute best tennis. Playing against somebody who's sort of like streaking is so hard, especially if it's somebody you haven't played before, who's like playing out of their mind, who like you're not sure if they can even sustain this level or if you have a good plan for what they're doing, and being able to kind of like ride that out with tactics and experience and like defend when you need to defend, find the moments of weakness and probe. Like, there was just such a like intellectualism that she brought to her tennis throughout the tournament. And like, Rybakina was too much for her, but I kind of don't care, because it felt like it was like both a return to the Vika of old, but also like a more mature Vika. I loved seeing it. On the other hand, watching Maria Sakkari kind of like not break through again makes me feel like it's ready for her to maybe make some changes. She's another one of these like athlete specimen types who like maybe just needs a little bit more of an intellectual approach and better coaching, to be honest. And like, I think there's so much headspace. I mean, we haven't even talked about my favorite story, which is Aryna Sabalenka, but like, I cannot say enough amazing things about her. I picked her to win.
Look at you.
Thinking it was her time.
Oh, yeah, there
it
you go.
Was.
She was like, also, I mean,
come on, you know your stuff. Come on.
It's also not the craziest pick. I mean, she's not lost a match this year, but like in the women's field, picking anyone to win is
snaps.
A real crapshoot, because anybody, so many of them can win, and she did. And she not only just won, she like won.
She won
that tournament. Like, she won. She won that match. She won that set. She won that game. She won that point. Like, she, every part of it was just like her taking it. And that was so exciting, especially if you think about where she was a year ago, serving underhand, which is the most horrific, terrible experience to have to go through. As a tennis player, that was literally the worst time in my career where I got the yips on my serve and forgot how to hit it close to the box. Hard to describe how awful that is. And her working through it with like absolute grit, determination, and courage, to me, was just so wonderful. I, like I said, I will show that match to people who don't know that much about tennis as an advertisement for tennis.
Oh, I love these WTA bullet points. All of them spot on.
So many. I just have so many.
I mean, I could keep going for sure. I could have this whole show like this. Nick, favorite match on the women's side?
I mean, the final's up there, which that goes to Caitlin's point too. And it also goes back to what we were talking about earlier, is we need that kind of tennis in women's tennis. We need these matchups to then produce, and the drama. And I will say too, you know, the on-court coaching, there's obviously, you know, people are in different camps with that, but I actually thought that Rybakina, I'm even more impressed with her, because Vukic just talks at her for the entire match. And then it takes twice the concentration for her to try to process that information, try to ignore whatever she wants to ignore, and then also be able to play her best tennis, which I think is a wild. You know, there are so many good, great stories. I look at a player like Magda Linette, and I know that we've had these different breakthroughs from different players, but Linette's been out there, you know, working her ass off.
So happy for her.
And let's look at our different markets. You know, the Polish market loves tennis, and we have a world number one in Iga Świątek. But I was reminded that seeing Radwanska down under this year again, is that they love their tennis. So to have those sort of folks, I mean, when Simona, obviously, and if Simona's going to come back, the Romanian market loves Simona. Yeah, I don't know. The final sort of sticks out to me the most. And I think that at the back end of tournaments, like Caitlin's saying, the quality of Azarenka and the fact that she lost that match to Rybakina, those are the matchups we need. You need that quality at the end of a tournament.
Yep.
And I will say, guys, I humble brag, I was courtside for Sam Stosur's retirement.
Oh,
that's cool.
Matt Ebden did not play well in the match tiebreak. I will just throw it out there. But
not the first time hearing that, by the way.
Well,
it love was you, Matt, but you know.
We digress. The court three energy was incredible. It was everything Sam deserved. I kind of wish it would have been on Key Arena.
Yeah.
That would have been an even cooler venue. And Sam took it in. You know, she's like such a humble person. And she went out there and she stood there for 30 seconds. And it was just a roaring standing applause.
Ugh.
And I've spoken to Sonia a couple times in the last year, and she's ready to be home with her son more. They're two legends. And they've built legacies, which is what we love and respect in the sport.
It's so hard for me from a fan perspective to say goodbye to players. I mean, it just really is. I love Sam Stosur. I love Sonia Mirza, what they've done for tennis. I mean, I'm just such a big fan. I mean, Vika, for me, I was so proud of her. You know, I know her going into Melbourne, the conversations we had, she was really excited about it. You know, that's always a tough trip. But, you know, really, really excited that she's leaving Melbourne feeling like she's excited for the season. You know, she's going to Doha. She's already training. Mm. She's already like back at the gym. She took very little time off. She just wants to see what this year can bring her. I really think it's really exciting.
Is she your favorite women's story, John? Not to put you on the spot or anything.
Yeah, I'm biased for sure. I mean, I was really happy because I, you know, the last time I saw her was on the dance floor at my wedding, and she's, you know, she's like, I'm going to have a great Melbourne. And I was like, all right. Yeah, she wasn't drinking. And I was like, all right, you better. If you're not having cocktails at my wedding, you better fucking win the whole thing.
She came really close. She came really close.
I know. So yeah, it was really great. I love, like I said, I love the Donna Vekic and the Magda Linette stories. I love those. You know, you're kind of plugging away for so long on tour. And yeah, Donna's been to a quarter before, but you know, it's like she's the things that she's been through, it's completely different world. She's in a second phase of her career. She probably had no idea what was going to happen. And that was great. I really love seeing that.
I think the meaning we can imbue, and I think that's why we tend to really, I think it's fun to discover new players, new energies, new vibes, all that stuff. But for me, it's like such a good and healthy and amazing thing when we see our faves, especially, you know, like in the case of Donna or Vika, who have, you know, these extended periods where they're, I don't know, sort of like forced to make a new relationship with the sport or recommit or maybe take away, you know, some time in a healthy way. Like that's such a nice narrative, and it's really becomes more meaningful when you see them get back to those places, when you see them get past something. In the case of Arena, being able to get past that semifinal that started to feel like a curse.
Yeah,
you know, so I feel like for me, I really do like watching through the years as we see these people, you know, grow and change, and you know, hopefully it's for the better, and they unlock some secrets that they can, you know, inspire us to try to unlock. Like I'm inspired to try to change my forehand because of watching Aryna Sabalenka fix her serve with a biomechanics expert. Like that's really cool. It's really cool.
Yeah, that is cool. It's real life there. I mean, everyone's on the therapy train, or most people are now of this generation.
Yeah.
It's real life therapy. It's them going out there and actually making, like Caitlin's saying, making those changes.
Yeah.
That's really damn hard to do. Imagine it in your own life and all the pressure that goes into making those changes. Yeah.
Yes, we do.
And also Pam Shriver with Donna Vekic. We need more female coaches in women's tennis. We need them. We need them. We need them. And I think that's a great partnership.
And let me just give some backup to Pam, because I don't know if we want to get into this, and I know we only have a few minutes left, but like Pam kind of went after Rybakina's coach, who a lot of us have seen just chewing this poor girl's head off. And I know she says that it's fine and she doesn't mind and she needs that and all that stuff. And look, I'm not here to contrast a narrative that a player has, but we know all too often that women, especially young women who come from places where they are told what to do, don't always have their own agency. And then we find out years later that all sorts of stuff was going on. And sadly, no one knows that better than Pam Shriver and her bravery in talking about some of the stuff that she went through as a teen with her coach who abused her. I just think that anybody, and especially in light of today's news with Alex Zverev, anybody whose inclination is to not believe women or not understand why there's a bit of protectiveness on behalf of especially some of the older women who've seen a lot and gone through a lot, my hope is that we collectively start to learn a little bit more. Like it's not coming out of a sense of like wanting to slam somebody. It's coming out of a sense of knowing sometimes all too well about what a lot of that can be indications of. That's not to say that that's what is happening, but to me, it's troubling. And when people like Pam call it out, and to be clear, she's not calling out anybody for abuse, just to say like, hey, this is maybe not okay. And maybe there's something else going on. That is coming out of a very hard won sense of wisdom. And so props to Pam. She came under a lot of fire for doing it. And I wish, frankly, that there were more people in tennis who kind of made that behavior even rarer. Because to me, it's not necessarily value add, even if there's not anything inappropriate going on. It looks and feels inappropriate in a way that I think is really triggering for a lot of people in this space. And I think sports in general should encourage that type of coaching or relationships to be well in the past.
Thank you. Thank you. Well said. We're wrapping up today with Caitlin Thompson and Nick McCarville. We have had such a great hour. Before we wrap up today, I do want to hear your secondary stories. There were so many great things that happened. I mean, there was the ball kid controversy and, you know, Novak's father, we'll skip that. It's not the rule, Carolyn. You know, there were so many great things that came out. Camilla Giorgi's press conference. Love this woman.
And yet she keeps doing so much wrong.
So much wrong.
Deep irony of the Camilla Giorgi experience.
I mean...
All right. Happy slam moments.
Yeah, I've got a couple. The AO far and away does Pride better than any of the slams. I co-hosted an event with Danny Laidley, who is an out trans former AFL, which is the equivalent to an NFL coach, is now out as trans and is a very layered individual, as we all are, but is brave in sharing her story. We had a great night pre-open, and then I missed at the end. Pride Day was the second Friday.
Glam Slam.
The Glam Slam, yeah, which is incredible for those players to play, but they also sold 2,400 tickets to the Glam Slam finals and Vanessa Amorosi performing, which I just thought that was really cool. And Tennis Australia sort of walks the talk in that space, which I think is huge. And then I love... You know, for the Aussie players who oftentimes have to pack their bags for, you know, 6-9 months of the year. I know that was heartbreaking for Thanasi, but he had success in Adelaide. He had a couple big wins in Melbourne. I loved the run of Rinky and Jason Kubler. I thought that was really cool.
The first time they've ever played doubles together. I mean, come on, how do you go
insane.
From here? I mean, it's all downhill now.
Hopefully up. Yeah. I mean, the Aussies know how to play doubles. And, you know, someone like Kim Birrell, who's just the nicest, you know, salt of the earth individual to have a day one win over Kaia Kanepi or day two on Kia Arena. Those are the stories that we love in slams that sometimes get lost in the noise.
You know, I'm going to continue Nick's celebration of how Tennis Australia has done such a good job of platforming voices and opening the door. And it would be a real miss if I, as one of the three LGBTQ members of this podcast, did not thank Laura Robson for being such a thoughtful, great commentator, which she always is, but just like also somebody who kind of put her money where her mouth is when asked on Eurosport about why she was wearing the pride flags and calling Margaret Court's views on human beings inexcusable. And we're not just talking about like a preference here. We're talking about believing in conversion therapy, shock therapy, taking parents away from children. You know, just really, there's no excuse for having a bigot like her in our sport. She supported apartheid, as I love to remind people. So like, just like a great gal all around and not somebody we should have a stadium named after. So shout out to Laura Robson. In addition to all the amazing things that Nick just talked about in terms of platforming diverse voices in our sport to make sure that the door stays open and it's even wider for the people who come next. That to me is awesome. And shouting out people who are allies like her is just, you know, it's really nice. It was really lovely to see. So I know she's a good friend of yours, Nick. Really, really cool to hear her on the feed, but also to see her take a moment and just be like, you know what? Actually, here's what I have to say and here's what I'm doing this for. It was really nice. It was moving.
She crushed it, definitely.
Crushed it. Well, just like we're crushing this. I mean, could we crush it even further? I don't think so.
I know, but we're done. Come on.
It's over.
We absolutely need a part two. There's so much more to go into. I can't wait to see what's in store for this tennis season. I can't thank two of the greatest talents working in tennis so much for joining today. You can follow the legend, Caitlin Thompson, on Twitter at Caitlin_Thompson and at Racket Magazine. Also, do yourself a favor and visit racketmag.com today and purchase issue number 21 of Racket Magazine out. Featuring future world number one? Yeah.
I mean, listen, certainly number one in our hearts, Chin Wen Zheng. She's going to make waves. And Nick, I mean, listen, Nick, my favorite commentator, my co-conspirator, a Racket contributor, I'll let you give him the rest of his flowers, but what a joy. I don't get to do this enough with him. So thank you for bringing us together.
No, this has been so fun. Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
You must go follow the fantastic Nick McCarville on Instagram or Twitter at Nick McCarville. And if you're an ice skating fan like I am, you'll love Nick's coverage of the sport as much as you do his tennis, for sure. While you're on Instagram, shoot me a DM at John Garica. Let me know who you're a big fan of and who you'd like to hear on an upcoming show. Also, don't forget to follow us at Fantastic Tennis Pod or on Twitter at FanTennisPod. My name is John Garica, and thank you for listening. This has been fantastic.
Arrivederci. Ciao.